أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. So welcome to part 2 of our webinar on the rules of fasting in the month of Ramadan. There's a lot of things that we could be doing on this last weekend before the month of Ramadan, but those of us who have chosen to spend time learning about the deen, learning about the rules of God, in the hope that we can better serve Him, that's a cause for thanking Allah for that tawfiq. And so I ask that Allah reward all of you for your participation. This began yesterday. We had a seminar yesterday. Those of you who are not able to attend that, or if you wanted to get the PowerPoint or the audio for that, you can download it at the link that I've pasted into the chat window. The slides that I'll be presenting for today's presentation are also available at that same link. Okay, I just want to make sure that my screen is showing up here. Do you see a slide which now says what we'll cover, inshallah? Okay, great. In yesterday's webinar, we covered the first topic of do I need to fast? And if I don't need to fast, what are the consequences? Today, we'd like to begin with the second bullet point, which is when do I fast? And as part of that, we're going to cover issues regarding moon sighting and also issues regarding the starting and stopping of fasting. And then we'll continue there from there to talk about how should I fast and what are the consequences of not fasting. Okay, so when do I fast? Meaning, when does it become wajib? When does this obligation arrive? The month of Ramadan begins when one of the following occurs. Number one is that I see the new crescent with my own eyes. That becomes a hujjah for me, a proof that the next day is now going to be the first of the month of Ramadan. There's a difference of opinion between Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei regarding how this can take place. Ayatollah Sistani says that it has to be seen by the naked eye, not without the use of a device like a telescope. Whereas Ayatollah Khamenei says that an optical device like binoculars or a telescope can also be used. Another way of it being a proof of it beginning is that if I don't see it, but two local adil witnesses do report having seen it, or so many people report having seen it locally, that I derive conviction, meaning there's no way that they could be wrong about this. Or I derive conviction through other means. Maybe there's some statement issued by a very trustable organization or whatever it may be that causes me to have a conviction within myself that yes, it is indeed going to be the month of Ramadan and the moon has been sighted. Ayatollah Khamenei also mentions another way, which is that the wali faqih, the jurist who is in charge and governing, or the mujtahid who is in charge, he can issue a decree, and that's another way that the month could become the start of the month for us. Another way is if 30 days of the previous month have passed. So if for example there's 30 days of Sha'aban have passed and the moon wasn't seen on the at the end of the 29th day, then the next day after 30 days of Sha'aban, it would obviously become the month of Ramadan. One thing to mention is that trying to sight the moon, which is that process is called istihlal, and that's something which is mustahab, and it's a very good practice for us to be doing as communities, as individuals, and there's a lot of lessons that one can derive and a lot of insight that one can gain from doing so, because here we are, human beings, we think that we're so technologically advanced and we've made so much progress, but yet we have to, it's a humbling experience for us to have to go and look for that crescent moon and to see and anticipate it actually, and to be waiting for the arrival of this blessing, which is the month of Ramadan. Yes, according to Ayatollah Sistani, one can use an optical aid like a binoculars or a telescope to find the moon, they can, if they can see it with the naked eye as well, then it would be considered as a valid sighting, according to Ayatollah Sistani. If the Waliya Faqih issues a decree according to the rulings of Ayatollah Khamenei, then we have to see whether that decree is something which applies to only a particular region or whether it applies to all Muslimin. And that we can derive from the wording of that decree. Okay, now, does an out-of-town sighting count? meaning that if somebody else, if it's not seen locally, but it's seen somewhere else, does that count for me? It can count. And that's if the sighting necessitates sighting in my own area. Meaning that if it's seen somewhere, and it's seen in such a way that it would be seen locally as well had it not been for other impediments. For example, let's say in my area there's bad weather, meaning it's cloudy and we try to go see the moon, but we can't because of the clouds. Now, if it's seen somewhere else, whereby on a scientific level, on an astronomical level, if it's seen there, it would also be seen here, then that sighting would count for my area as well. There's a slight difference here between the ruling of Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani. Ayatollah Khamenei, the range is a bit wider. He says that as long as there is a possibility of sighting it in my area, meaning that if it's seen in place X, which is a little bit some other place in the world, and astronomically speaking, there's a possibility if it's seen there that it would be seen in my area, then that would be enough for me to consider that sighting as valid for mine. Whereas Ayatollah Sistani says that no, it has to be the case that it would be, meaning that it's not a possibility, meaning that if it's seen there, then it would also be seen here. I should mention here a point that we shouldn't think that sighting the moon is something which is very trivial and it can be something which is predicted. Yes, we know precisely the position of the moon, like the time it's going to rise, the time it's going to set, exactly where it is in relation to the sun and other factors. Those things are calculated without any problem. But the possibility of being able to see the moon while standing on Earth, that's something which is very complex and it involves a number of different factors. And whatever we can calculate through the different formulas, that just gives us an approximation. But we actually have to go and try to see it as well in order to be sure that it can be seen. That's why sometimes you'll see that the moon prediction charts will predict, for example, that in a certain area the moon cannot be seen. But when people go, they are able to see it and they're able to prove that they can see it. That's because whatever methods they have to predict, that's all based on guesswork, and it's not something which is gives us confidence. Now, how do we know whether an out-of-town sighting counts for us or not? Whether seeing it there would necessitate being able to see it here as well too? There's a few different factors that need to be taken into consideration. One of them is the altitude of the moon, the magnitude of the moon, meaning how big the moon is going to be. Another one is the time that the crescent will remain in the horizon after the sunset. And another factor which is called the azimuth, the elongation of the moon. It's not something which is straightforward. It needs to be looked into a little bit more and understood better. It's not something that requires a degree either in physics. It's something that anybody with a bit of diligent study can come to understand and to apply. But the reason why we have bodies of ulama who work in conjunction with scientists to be able to determine and help believers understand when the month has started and not is because of this reason, that it's not something which is absolutely straightforward. And that's why we should refer to the experts on the matter, try to understand who is it that has that expertise and then rely on their opinion for these sorts of matters if we ourselves haven't learned these things. Now, that is regarding the start of the month. What about the start of the fast in the daytime? Now, it is clear that this is something that we're all aware of, that the fasting has to take place from the Fajr to the Maghrib. The Fajr being the true dawn, and not the false dawn, which is something that appears on the sky before the true dawn. And Maghrib, which is not the sunset, but rather it's when the redness in the eastern sky has faded out into darkness. The sun sets in the west, when the sun goes down, there's still redness in the sky, and that redness will slowly disappear and be replaced by darkness. And when in the eastern sky it has faded out into darkness, then Maghrib has started. Now, fasting needs to take place from when one is certain that Fajr has set in until one is certain that the time for Maghrib has arrived. This is what we have to keep in mind. That if, for example, I'm looking at a timetable, and there's a time there which is labeled usually as Imsak, and that time, let's say, is 10 minutes before the Fajr time. Okay, now, I have to understand what is it that the person who made that timetable wants me to understand from these different times. If from the Imsak time, the person is saying that, look, this is a time which it's before Fajr, but it's a time that you should stop eating out of precaution. And the Fajr column is the time when Fajr, the best calculation they could come up with as to when Fajr time is, then the time that I'm certain that Fajr will set in will be the column that has the Fajr time, right? Not the column that has the Imsak time, in which case I don't need to stop eating by the Imsak time. Of course, according to ihtiyat, meaning the principle of taking precaution, that's something which is mustahab and something which is good to do. So out of precaution, I will try to stop by that Imsak time column. But in terms of my fast becoming invalid if I don't stop by that, no. As long as I'm not certain that Fajr has set in, then I am able to continue eating until I'm certain that Fajr has set in. But of course, precaution is something which is good to take. Now this continues until I'm certain that Maghrib has arrived. If on the timetable it says that, it gives you a column and it says that, okay, this is a time for when Maghrib will arrive, but there's 2 minutes, there's a 2 minute margin of error, then I have to make sure that I add that 2 minutes in order to be sure that Maghrib has arrived, and that's when I have to stop eating. This is, of course, if I use a timetable. If I can see it myself when it comes to the Maghrib, then that's even better, because then the timetable, after all, is just a means for me to gain conviction, a means of understanding what the time is. Okay. How can we be certain that it is Fajr time? What does the sky look like? What they describe is that before the true dawn appears, there will be a false dawn, and the false dawn appears like a column of light that just vertically like shoots up. And then after that, there's the true dawn, which is not a column that goes vertical, but rather like a curtain of light which spreads across the horizon. When this takes place, this is something that we need to gain practice and we need to experience in order to like understand exactly what this involves. Unfortunately, in today's world with city lights, being on at night, it's really difficult for somebody who's in the city to be able to see when the Fajr actually is. You have to really go outside of the city and be in a place where you have a view of the horizon where the sun is going to be rising in order to see this actually happen. And if you ever are in that position, if somebody is living in a rural area or they go on vacation, for example, to a camping site and they're able to like witness this, it's a very good thing and to understand what this phenomenon actually entails. If we can't do it in the absence of that, we have to rely on other means, for example, somebody who's reliable who tells us, some other people who have gone and sighted the Fajr on a regular basis and they've recorded their timings or calculations that give us conviction. I'm following Adil Sasani and two other people tell me that they saw the moon. Do I have to inquire if they used optical aid or not? Yes, you would have to do that because not only is it necessary to establish a sighting, it has to be, meaning that according to Ayatollah Sistani, a true sighting is a sighting that is done with a naked eye. So if somebody just says that, oh, we saw the moon, and you don't have conviction that they mean by the naked eye, then you have to ask. But if you know, if you have conviction that, okay, what they mean is they mean the naked eye, then you don't have to ask. Where I live, Imsak is 2:50 and Fajr is 3:20. That is a very large time of precaution that's mentioned there. And it's something which seems overly precautionary. And it makes life a little bit difficult as well too. So what I would suggest is that you consult with the local ulama, try to get them to come up with a more modern, up-to-date timetable that reduces that error, that margin. But in the absence of that, I mean, if this is all that you have, this is what you have, this is what you go for. Out of precaution, you would have to stop. If you wanted to act according to precaution, you would stop at the Imsak time. But as I mentioned, according to the viewpoint of Ayatollah Sistani, at least, when one is certain that Fajr has set in, that's when they have to stop eating. So if I'm not certain that Fajr has set in, then I'm okay to keep on eating until I'm certain. So when I look at that timetable, I have to see what sort of certainty it's giving me regarding when this Fajr sets in. As you'll notice, I put in parentheses Ayatollah Sistani there. The reason is because even though I'm pretty sure the same rule applies according to the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei, there was something that I came across which led me to feel a little bit of uncertainty regarding that, and so I didn't want to ascribe this viewpoint to Ayatollah Khamenei. If this becomes an issue for somebody, please email me privately, and I will ask the office and see what we can understand from them regarding it. I should mention here that the third bullet point, the timings need to be ascertained with conviction. Timetables are just an approximation. They don't give us the exact time, and there's usually a couple of minutes that have to be taken into account for precaution. And so it's good for us to understand whether this precaution has been built into the timings or not. Alhamdulillah, there's a lot of efforts going on, and a lot of good work has been done in this area, and there's programs now that you can get for your web browsers, for your iPhones and your smartphones that will give you a pretty good indication of the timings, but still having a couple of minutes here and there is good to observe as a precaution. Now, unintentionally eating or drinking past Fajr time. Let's say that I'm just eating and drinking, I'm not really paying attention to the timetable and to the timings, and suddenly I realize that I've eaten past the Fajr time. In that case, because I was careless about the timing, then my fast is going to be invalid. But if, on the other hand, I'm careful about the arrival of the timing, but something happens, my clock is running slow, or it's something out of my own control, and then I realize that, oh, by mistake, I had eaten past the Fajr time, in that case, then my fast will be valid. How does the margin of error change as you go further from the equator? That's something that I'm not 100% sure on, but one thing for sure that I do understand about the timings and where we live is that the further north we go, the shorter the for the most part, from what I've seen, the shorter the nights and the longer the daytimes. Is that correct? So if that's the case, if we have a shorter let's put it this way, margin of error that we're talking about here is something that we can easily find out by looking at the timetables, because what they do is they take into account our latitude and longitude as well too. So if you can use these, for example, one of them is a website called praytime.info, which gives, according to pretty good calculations, the timing. Again, precautions should be taken for that, but we can refer to that, and then you can plug it in and see for yourself what it shows for your location. Okay. praytime.info. Okay. There's also a good article that was written by Sayyid Muhammad Radavi, or Rizvi, who is a well-known alim in North America here. The article is about the prayer timings, and it's about the Fajr time in particular. Those of you who are interested in reading further about it, about that, you can find that article on alislam.org. And it's called, I believe, Al-Fajr As-Sadiq, the true dawn. Anyway, if you search for dawn and Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi, you should be able to find that article and find out more about what the issues are regarding the moon sighting, regarding the prayer times. Now, there's a question that comes up about places where there's no night or no complete darkening that takes place. Right now, in some parts of the world, the night is very short. Some parts it's non-existent. In some parts, there is a night, but it doesn't get to be truly dark. And the redness in the eastern sky never actually disappears. There's always brightness in the sky. So in those cases, what do we do? According to Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, if there is some sort of period of darkening, even if the redness doesn't disappear, as long as there is a period of darkening, then as soon as it lights up, then that would be the beginning of the Fajr. As if there's no night at all, and we happen to be living in a place that at this time of the year it's always daytime, then in that case, according to Ayatollah Sistani, it's wajib to move to another place during Shahr Ramadan. If that would not entail unbearable difficulty and circumstances, in that case, then one would have to make up the do qada of the fasting at another time. I wasn't able to find the ruling of Ayatollah Khamenei on this particular issue where you're living in a place where there is no night at all. And in these places where there is, where there are very long fasts, even in places which aren't so far north, during this particular Shahr Ramadan, the Ramadan that's coming up, there are places that will have nights of like, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours. The same rules that we talked about yesterday regarding weakness, regarding harm, regarding sickness, regarding excessive difficulty, those apply. And so if it's a case that somebody cannot do it, or it's very, very difficult, or it causes harm, then the rulings will apply that we talked about yesterday. Yes, there was a question about what is the ruling of Ayatollah Khamenei. As I explained, I wasn't able to get a certain ruling on that, meaning that there was something that I saw that gave me some doubt regarding exactly what the ruling is from Ayatollah Khamenei on that issue. And so if you need to find out that ruling, then please email me, and inshallah I will ask from the office and get back to you. Okay, now it's mustahab to perform the Maghribin prayers before iftar. This is according to some of the marajit. I wasn't able to, again, get confirmation that this is something that all the marajit say to be definitely the case. But some of the marajit have mentioned this, that it's good to do this, and the reason behind that is that one will have performed all the five prayers in the state of fasting. Meaning from the Fajr time, we begin fasting before the Fajr, we recite our Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib, and Isha. But that's mustahab if it's not the case that somebody's waiting for us to finish and to do, in order for them to do their iftar. Or if we do so, then that will cause us not be able to have proper attention, proper concentration, because we're, you know, hungry or we're anticipating the iftar. In that case, it would no longer be mustahab to perform the prayers before the iftar. Okay, the next topic is how should I fast? Let me just pause here for a minute. Is there any questions about the timing issues before we go on? Yeah, the question is that in for the month of Sha'ban in California, the moon was seen. In British Columbia, we could not follow. Why is that? The ruling here is that it has to be the case that if it's seen in a place, then it would have been seen in our location as well, had it not been for other impediments. Okay? Now, just because British Columbia and California are both on the West Coast, it doesn't mean that necessarily that if it can be seen in one place, then it can be seen in the other place. There's other factors involved, like those different parameters that I mentioned, the azimuth, the time that the crescent is born, etc. And so that's where we need to refer to these different figures and understand, meaning that somebody has to refer to that. Now, as long as it's not established for us that certainly if it were seen in California, then it would be seen in British Columbia, then it doesn't apply, that sighting does not apply to us. And we do have ulama, for example, Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi of Toronto, and others who quite actively are involved with looking at these different figures and helping us understand when it is a case that a sighting in one place does apply to another place, according to the rulings of Ayatollah Sistani, at least. Okay, how should I fast? Now, the first step is having a niyyah, having an intention. And a niyyah is something that you perform, that you have while performing an act of worship. Sometimes we think of it as being something that we do before we start and then it's over with. But no, a niyyah is something that you have, it's a state of being that you have while you're performing an act of worship. Look at the picture here. There's a child who, on an outward level, is supposedly praying, but clearly his intention differs from many of those around him. Now, how do I know if I have a correct niyyah? It should be the case that if somebody were to ask me why I'm fasting, let's say I wake up at sahar time and somebody asks me, hey, why are you having your suhoor so early here? What are you planning on doing? We should know and we should be able to respond that I'm fasting in the month of Ramadan out of obedience to him because he told me to do so out of pleasing him in order to get close to him, etc. Now, I do need to intend to fast, meaning I can't just start without any thought about what I'm going to be doing. I have to have some resolution, internal resolution, to be fasting for the month of Ramadan. And there's three options by which I can establish this resolution and this intention. Number one is by Fajr time each day. Before Fajr, or by Fajr the night of, I make that intention that, okay, the next day I'm going to be fasting. Now, if I forget to do so, and I remember before the time of Dhuhr, and I haven't done anything to break my fast, then I can still make the intention to fast. But if I remember after Dhuhr, then the rule applies, as I mentioned there on the slide there. That was option number one. Option number two is that I make the intention before the month begins. So, on the night of the first of the month of Ramadan, I find out that, okay, tomorrow's going to be the first, and I make the intention that, looking for the next, for the entire month, I tell Allah, and I tell myself, and I make a pledge to obey the command of Allah to fast in the next month. And this intention should be something which I keep present throughout the month, meaning that I have that state of awareness about me. If somebody were to ask me, I would be able to understand. Even though it might be something that recedes deep inside of me, I might not be focused on that and have it at the forefront of my mind at all times. But if somebody were to ask me, I would be able to explain why I'm doing what I'm doing. Option number three is that I do it at both times, meaning that both before before the month begins, I make this intention, and also before each fast in order to get more thawab, meaning that on a nightly basis or on a morning basis before the Fajr time, I'm reminding myself of what I'm doing and I'm recommitting myself to obeying the command of Allah. Now, what happens if it's the 30th of the month of Sha'ban? I'm not sure if the moon was seen yet. In that case, I'm not sure, and so I don't need to fast. But if I do fast out of precaution, because I want to, in case it is the month of Ramadan, then I should not intend that this is a fast for the month of Ramadan, because the month of Ramadan hasn't actually been established for me. I can, however, make an intention that I'm fasting, and if it's the month of Ramadan, let it be a fast for the month of Ramadan. And if it's not the month of Ramadan, then let it be for the month of Sha'aban. That's perfectly okay. Now, if in that day where it's a day of uncertainty whether it's the first or not, if I am fasting and I do find out that the moon was sighted, for example, and it is the first, then I can convert my niyyah to be one for it being a month of Ramadan. If I had done the niyyah of it being for the month of Sha'ban before, and if I'm not fasting, meaning that I did eat something and then I find out halfway through the day that, hey, wait a minute, today is the first day of the month, then I can start fasting if I haven't done anything to invalidate it, if it's before Dhuhr. Otherwise, if I've eaten something or it's past Dhuhr, then I have to just refrain from doing anything from now on until the end of the day, and I would have to make the qada up at the end of the month. Now, this is an important point here, that we have to keep the niyyah of fasting throughout the fast. Meaning that if we... If at any point we make the intention to break the fast, meaning that, you know what, I no longer want to keep this fast, even though I haven't done any act, I haven't like drank water, or I haven't eaten food yet, for example, just the intention to no longer hold myself to these prohibitions, that itself is enough to break my fast. So, for example, let's say it's really hot outside, you know, I'm fasting, and I step outside, and suddenly I find myself doubting whether I can really stick it out. And I, you know, I say, okay, let me have some juice. In this case, right here, that itself would be enough to break my fast. Now, for some reason, I had updated this slide on my copy. I didn't get into this one right here. I should just mention here that this is according to the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, If I'm not sure yet, meaning that I'm still in the state of doubt, I'm still trying to decide whether I should keep it or I shouldn't keep it, in that case, my fast is still intact. But the moment, according to all Maharaja, the moment that I decide to no longer fast, at that point my fast is broken, whether or not I've actually done anything or not. And so I would have to do qada for that fast. Yeah, if your intention was made at the beginning of the month and now during the middle you have to skip a fast, or you have to skip a few fasts, but you have to renew that intention, that goes back to our understanding of intention. Intention has to be something that's always there within us when we're performing an act of ibadah, and fasting is an act of ibadah. So definitely, if I haven't done it for a few days, then when I want to do it again, I have to have that intention within me. And for the most part, we will have it within us. It's not that we just will be so negligent that we won't be thinking about what we're doing. But this is just a reminder that we should actually, you know, at least have that come into our hearts and minds that we are doing this act of worship. There's a question about if it was a sunnah fast. If you can please explain a little bit more about your question. And... Oh, well, you can break... It's okay to break a fast which is mustahab. There's no problem in that. And it doesn't require... There's no penalty attached to that. Okay. Now, step one, as I mentioned, was making the intention. Now, step two is to refrain from 9 things from Fajr until Maghrib. These 5 things are mentioned here on this slide. I won't be covering all of them. I'll be covering those which I felt were come up more often and where people might have more questions about. But just take a look at this slide. Most of the issues we will actually be covering, but there's a few that, a couple like the liquid enema that I won't be mentioning. Okay. Now, obviously, one has to refrain. We have to refrain from eating or drinking from the Fajr till the Maghrib. If I have food in my mouth at Fajr time, then I have to spit it out. I can't go ahead and just swallow it just because it's there. So, is it the case that all eating and drinking makes my fast invalid? No, there's some conditions. First of all, it has to be deliberate. If it's the case that I forget that I'm fasting, you know, I see a water fountain just out of habit, I go and I drink the water, and then I realize that, oh, wait a minute, I'm fasting, then that does not invalidate my fast. That's something which is a rizq from Allah. According to hadith, that's a rizq from Allah that He's given us. And I can continue making my fast once I remember that I'm fasting and I come to my attention. It comes to my attention that I'm fasting. Another one is that it has to be swallowed. If if I just have food in my mouth, I'm just tasting it, for example, or I have food particles stuck in my mouth and now it's Fajr time, in that case, I don't need to... I haven't invalidated my fast because I haven't eaten anything. I don't even need to clean my teeth unless I know that if I don't clean it, then I will swallow some of the food that's stuck in there. But I can even go about cleaning it after the Fajr time sets in. Another condition is that it has to be from the outside, meaning that food which is inside of me, like for example my saliva is not something that I'm eating or drinking from the outside. Even though I might bring it to my mouth, I might swallow it again, that's perfectly okay. The only case where saliva would be a problem is if I have saliva and then somehow it goes outside of my mouth and I bring it back into my mouth. That would be considered as invalidating my fast because I'm drinking something from the outside. Now, coughing up or spitting up something, we'll talk about that on the next slide. The other point is that it should be through the mouth. So when I'm getting food or drink and it's not through the mouth, it's through another means like an IV. In that case, it doesn't always invalidate the fast. And we'll talk about that soon, inshallah. So let's say that this is an issue that comes up all the time. If you cough up something, like some phlegm or congestion or mucus. Now, what's the ruling here? We have to see, first of all, does it come into the mouth or not? If it just goes up to like the throat level and then we swallow it down, then there's no problem. Our fast is intact. But if it comes into the mouth, then there's a difference of opinion here. According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's better not to swallow it and to spit it out, but if you do, there's no problem. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat wajib not to swallow that thing which has come into the area of the mouth. If it is swallowed deliberately, then one would have to do qada and pay kafara as well too. And so if, you know, just as a tip, if somebody has a cold, has congestion, and they're fasting, and they're acting according to this fatwa, then it's good for them to have a handkerchief or some tissues in case that happens so they can easily spit it out. But as I mentioned, if it's not doesn't come into the mouth, then it's okay to swallow it back down. Now, can I rinse my mouth with water when fasting? The same rules apply, that if I'm not drinking the water, it's fine. But this is as long as I'm certain that I can control myself. Some people can't control themselves. They when they put water in their mouth, it goes down. In that case, I can't do it. But it seems that at least it's from my just observation that it seems that most people are able to control themselves in this regard, and it's okay for them to put water. It is recommended to spit out 3 times after rinsing because it's not okay just to swallow as soon as that water, we've just spit it out once because some of it is still left behind, and if we were to swallow it, then that would be considered swallowing something from the outside. But it is recommended to spit 3 times so that water we get rid of that water. And as I mentioned, in some cases, if it is swallowed, then qada would be necessary. If, for example, I'm not certain in my ability to control myself and I swallow it, then qada would be necessary. Can I clean my teeth when I'm fasting? Yes, brushing, even with toothpaste and flossing as well too, even with flavored floss, even if the toothbrush is wet, that is permissible as long as nothing is swallowed deliberately. But if I'm brushing my teeth and something happens by mistake, I swallow some toothpaste, then because it wasn't deliberate, then my fast is still intact. Using a wet toothbrush is makruh, I should mention, as it says on the second bullet point there. Now, something to keep in mind that we have other rules that apply here as well too. If somebody doesn't brush their teeth at all when they're fasting, they might be troubling others with their bad breath. And in some cases, that can be something which is haram, because troubling believers is something which is considered to be haram. It's a ruling. It's a haram thing. So, it's a good thing to keep ourselves, you know, presentable, keep ourselves clean, keep ourselves in a way that people would not find us repelling. And so, it's good to brush at least before Fajr. We should brush and use toothpaste. If we don't want to do the thing which is makruh, then we can use a dry toothbrush and put toothpaste on it and brush that way. And that way, there's no problem in it. It's not even makruh either. Can I take medicine? Medicine that enters through the mouth, like pills and syrups, that's not going to be okay. Unless, of course, I have to do it. Meaning that if I don't have this medicine, then I'm going to cause harm. The fasting is going to cause harm to my body. In that case, as we mentioned yesterday, that if that harm is something which is considerable, then I would not be able to fast, and I would have to take that medicine. An inhaler. Now, there was a question about this yesterday as well, too. The inhaler, if it's something which is going into the respiratory tract, I mean, I'm breathing it into my you know, sort of respiratory system, that's okay. But if it's something which I'm breathing and I'm also swallowing some medicine, and that's going into my digestive system, and it's going into my throat, and I'm swallowing it down, then it would be problematic. And then the same rule that would apply that we mentioned yesterday. Okay, there's some questions. How much are you allowed to eat if you are fasting because of taking medicine? Meaning not fasting because you're taking medicine. So, if somebody is not fasting because they're taking medicine and they're doing this because of the harm entailed in fasting, if they were to fast, then they would not be able to take that medicine, and that would then cause considerable harm to their body. In that case, then it's mustahab to refrain from like eating and drinking during and the other things that are mentioned during the daytime. Is it makruh to rinse your mouth afterwards? No, it's not makruh, but excessive rinsing of the mouth is makruh. Where somebody, if you were to do it like excessively, also if somebody is not certain, like meaning that they don't have that ability, they're not confident that when they're rinsing their mouth that they won't swallow. In that case, then they shouldn't put water in their mouth and rinse when they're fasting. That's something that I mentioned here on this slide, that can you rinse your mouth with water when fasting? This applies even when we're brushing our teeth. Yes, we can rinse it as long as we don't swallow, and we're certain that we can control ourselves. If we're certain, but by mistake we still do it, then we're okay. I mean, the fast is still intact. Regarding the rulings on brushing the teeth, these are according to Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei, both. What about eye drops, nose drops, ear drops? These are okay even if it's the case that we taste something in our mouth, as long as we're not eating it. We're not like, you know, eating or drinking something. It's not that it's reaching our throat. Just having a taste in the mouth is something which is okay. And obviously it should not be used as a way of eating or drinking. Injections, if it's a medicinal injection while fasting, then it's okay. If it's something which is anesthetic, then according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's okay, according to Ayatollah Sistani, it's better to avoid it, but it's still allowed. Meaning that, you know, I want to, some part of my body needs to get anesthetized, or my mouth, for example. If it's a food-based injection, meaning that I'm getting food through this, it's an IV. In that case, according to Ayatollah Sistani, it's better to avoid it, but it's allowed. Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat-e wajib to avoid it. And if it's a vaccination, according to Ayatollah Sistani, it's okay. Ayatollah Khamenei says that as long as the vein is not injected, meaning that if it's done in the muscle but not the vein, then it's okay. There are some things which are better to avoid. rinsing with water excessively, smelling fragrance from herbs or flowers, but perfume is okay. So smelling perfume is not a problem. A wet toothbrush for brushing, that's, as I mentioned before, it's better to avoid it. Tooth extraction or any other action which will cause bleeding in the mouth, it's better to avoid that. And pointless argumentation and dispute, in general, that's something which is makruh, but especially when we're fasting, to just be arguing without any divine purpose, just for the sake of argumentation, without having proper knowledge and certainty about what we're talking about, in that case it's also makruh. Vaccinations, Ayatul Sistani, it's okay. Now, what about vomiting? Vomiting breaks my fast if it's done deliberately. Meaning that if I make myself vomit, I force myself to do so. But if it's something which happens and it's involuntary, in that case, then my fast would be intact. Now, suppose I feel like vomiting, I'm nauseous. Do I have to stop myself from vomiting? Yes, I do need to do so if it's going to cause, as long as it won't cause harm or intolerable difficulty, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and it's not necessary according to Ayatollah Sistani. Can I eat at night if I know that it will make me vomit? Some people are sensitive, and you know they know that if they eat a certain thing, then they'll throw up the next day. In that case, I can do that, but after vomiting, then I might have to do qada, according to what I explained on the slide right there. Now, what about belching? Belching, in case you're wondering, means to basically to burp, to expel gas noisily from the stomach through the mouth. Now, if this happens, if it's just a matter of air passing out, then that's okay. But what happens if vomit or food or drink will come up? Now, according to the star here means that there's a difference of opinion on this matter regarding Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei. This slide is according to Ayatollah Sistani that if I belch and if vomit and or food or drink will come up, then I'm not allowed to belch. But if I know that, but if I don't know, then meaning I'm not sure if it's going to be wet or it's going to be dry, then it's okay to belch even if food comes up. But obviously, once it comes up, then I'm not allowed to eat it back down again. So basically, just to put it simply, we have to see: do I know that this is going to be something which is wet? If it's wet, then I shouldn't make it happen. Now, what is this star regarding here? There's a bit of difference of opinion here regarding whether if it's just vomit and food and drink. Let me go back and take back what I said. I said that this slide reflects the opinion of Ayatollah Sistani. Actually, this slide reflects the most, meaning the safest thing. That if somebody observes this, they're going to be okay. Now, there is a slight difference of opinion, but if you stick to what I said right here, then you'll be okay whether you apply the rules of Ayatollah Sistani or Ayatollah Khamenei. Inhaling dust and smoke breaks my fast when the inhaling is deliberate and the dust or smoke is thick and it reaches my throat. So there's some examples for one of them is smoke from cigarettes or tobacco. That according to Ihtiyat al-Wajib is not allowed when fasting. Even if somebody's addicted to cigarettes, they're not allowed to have them when they're fasting. And that's not addressing the issue of whether it's halal or haram to smoke or not. That's a different issue. I'm not addressing that. This is just about fasting. If somebody's sweeping and the air becomes dusty, they're not allowed to deliberately inhale that dust. And steam, if there's just normal steam that happens to be in the kitchen because the pressure cooker is on, that's fine. But if it's steam is to that extent that it condenses in my mouth and I swallow it, then it will be a problem. Can I deliberately put my head under water while fasting? This, again, the title of the slide is important here. The ruling has to do with putting the head, the entirety of the head, under water. And this doesn't have to do with the rest of the body. It just has to do with the head itself. Whether the rest of the body is there or not, that's irrelevant to this particular ruling. According to Adil al-Khamini, it's ihtiyat, wajib to avoid doing so, and it invalidates the fast. According to Adil al-Sistani, it's allowed, meaning that somebody can put their head underwater while fasting, but it's severely makruh, meaning that it's something which is disliked, but it's not something which is prohibited in this case. Showering is okay, because when we're showering, even if the water is coming down really hard, we're not putting our whole body, our whole head underwater. Taking a bath is also okay, as long as we don't put our head underneath the water. It is makruh, however, for a woman to sit in water when fasting. Now, if you breathe in flour, if that breathing in is done unintentionally, then there's no problem. If it's done intentionally, then, which I don't think usually it's done, but if it's done intentionally, then we have to see, does it result in, is it like a thick dust thing that there's a thick dust in the air, it's a lot of flour, then that would be a problem. That would be considered as deliberate inhaling, and it's dust and it's thick, and if it reaches the throat as well too, then it'll be a problem. Okay? If not, meaning it's not very thick or it doesn't reach the throat, then it wouldn't be a problem. It would not invalidate the fast. What about using a hair? What about using a hair dye during fasting? There's no problem in doing so. Meaning that it's not haram. I haven't come across anything which says that it would be makruh. Meaning that I don't know, I haven't seen anything which says that it is makruh, and it's definitely not something which invalidates the fast. Okay. Some other things that will break my fast, one of them is sexual intercourse. That would break the fast. And what about other acts, like, for example, kissing and other acts that would happen between two spouses? That in and of itself is not something which is haram. But if it leads to something happening that would, for example, ejaculation, in that case, then it would be haram, and it would cause the fast to break. And also, if somebody is not, let's say, like they're not certain of themselves, they're engaging in these, and they're not sure whether they can, like, you know, rein it in. In that case, they wouldn't be allowed to engage even in those other acts that potentially would lead to the fast being broken. Istimna, which normally is translated as masturbation, that also would invalidate the fast. Now, we should mention here that masturbation, it depends on how you define it, but the definition of istimna is that any deliberate act that causes a discharge of semen, whether it's a physical act of somebody, for example, touching themselves in a certain way, or other acts as well too, for example, watching certain films, or even thinking certain thoughts that would cause this to take place. This would be something that would be considered istimna, and would break somebody's fast as well. Intentionally remaining in the state of janaba or hayd or nifas until the fajr time, that would also be something that would cause the fast to break. And we're going to explain that in a little bit more detail in just a bit here. So what happens if somebody enters, if I enter the state of janaba at night? In this situation, I have to realize that by the time Fajr sets in, I have to have done a ghusl of janaba, because I cannot deliberately stay in this state until the Fajr time. Now what happens if there's not enough time left to do a ghusl before Fajr, or I don't have the means to do ghusl? In that case, then tayammum would be wajib in place of ghusl. I would do the tayammum in order to enter the fast in a state of purity, and then in order to do the prayer of Fajr, I would have to do the ghusl then to say the Fajr prayer. And if somebody enters the state and there's not enough time to even do a tayammum, then in that case, qada would be mustahab. Now, if somebody doesn't do ghusl or tayammum, they deliberately stay in this state until Fajr time, then their fast would be batil. They would have to make up the fast and they would have to do the kafara as well too. Now, for a woman who becomes clean from hayd or nifas at night, the same thing, she would have to perform the ghusl before Fajr, or do tayammum if there's not enough time, or she's unable to perform the ghusl. Now, if I go to sleep at night after entering the state of janabah, is this allowed? Yes, it's allowed, as long as I'm intending on waking up before Fajr to do it. And I'm pretty sure, I'm confident that I'm going to wake up. You know, I set my alarm. I'm somebody who can usually wake up by setting my alarm. And that's fine. Now, if what happens is that I go to sleep and I oversleep past the Fajr time without waking up, in that case, then I'm okay. My fast is okay. I would have no qada. I would wake up and do the ghusl and say my Fajr prayer, and my fast would be okay. If somebody goes to sleep after having entered the state of janabah and they wake up once before Fajr and they check their alarm clock, they say, okay, wait, I still have more time left, I can go back to sleep again. They go back to sleep again and then they oversleep. In that case, they would have to do qada, and they have to make up the fast that they would have to refrain from eating or drinking for that day, and they have to make up the fast. The third situation is where somebody goes to sleep with the intention of waking up. They wake up, they go back to sleep again. They wake up, they go back to sleep again. And then they oversleep past Fajr. They wake up and they realize that, oh, it's already Fajr time, I haven't done the ghusl of janabah. In that case, they would owe qada and kafara, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. According to Ayatollah Sasani, the kafara is mustahab in this case right here. They would have to still do the ghusl in order to say their Fajr prayer. They would have to refrain from eating or drinking, and then they would have to then make up the fast and pay the kafara, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, otherwise, if somebody just goes to sleep and they don't really set an alarm, they're not in the habit of being able to wake up when they want to, they don't have any regard really for this ruling of having to perform ghusl and be pure before entering the fast. In that case, if they sleep past the Fajr time, they would have to do qada and pay kafara. Now, what if I enter the state of janabah while asleep? Meaning somebody is asleep and, for example, in their dreams something happens, they enter the state of janabah. If this happens, now if I wake up before Fajr, I have to do ghusl. And I can only go back to sleep if I intend to wake up before Fajr to do the ghusl, and I'm confident that I will do so. If I, I set an alarm, and I intend to wake up, but if I oversleep, then I would have to give a qada for that. If it happens after, when I wake up, I realize it's happened, I go back to sleep again. If I oversleep, then I would have to give the qada. If somebody wakes up after Fajr and they realize that this happened at night, they enter janabah at night, then their fast is intact. They would just have to do the ghusl in order to be able to say their Fajr prayers. There are slight differences in this particular ruling about what happens regarding going to sleep or not going to sleep after somebody realizes that he's entered this state during their sleep. There's slight differences in the rulings of Ayatollah Khamenei. I wasn't able to put them into the slide. If somebody has questions about that, they should email me. Now, if this happens in the daytime, somebody's sleeping in the daytime and in their sleep they enter the state of janabah, in that case, when they wake up, their fast is still intact. They would have to do ghusl in order to say their prayers, but their fast is still okay. Now, a common scenario where tayammum would become wajib, I already mentioned this, I just want to bring this to the forefront here, that tayammum might come up more frequently in the month of Ramadan than it does other times, because it might be the case that at other times we can do the ghusl and we have enough time, but in the month of Ramadan sometimes people are short on time because they're waking up, they don't have enough time to do ghusl maybe before the Fajr, maybe they just have time to just drink a glass of water and maybe do the tayammum. So it's important for us to understand how to do tayammum if this comes up. And that's outside of the scope of this presentation right here. But just wanted to point out that there is a use case in the month of Ramadan for knowing how to do tayammum and being able to perform it correctly. The last slide I have is regarding the kafara. If somebody deliberately breaks their fast through one of the means that we mentioned, eating or drinking, inhaling smoke, istimna, sexual interaction, etc. In that case, then for each fast that would be broken as such, they would have to make up that fast, do a qada for that fast. In addition, they would have to pay a penalty as well too, of either feeding 60 poor people to their fill or giving them one mud of food. We mentioned in yesterday's presentation what that mud is of food. So we said 750 grams of food. Or fasting for 2 months. Now, there's a bit of difference here in comparison to fidya. The fidya we mentioned yesterday, when somebody, for example, is elderly and they're not able to fast, or somebody is ill and they're not able to fast for the entire year, that even if you have multiple fidyas, that can be given to one person. But kafara has to be given to 60 different poor people, not the same person. You give them 60 portions. If you can find 60 poor people, then you have to give to 60 poor people. Now, in some cases, such as breaking the fast by eating food which is haram, meaning that not only are we breaking the fast deliberately, but we're doing it through an act which is haram, like eating food which is haram, both of these penalties may apply. But there is difference of opinion here regarding when this happens and exactly which acts. And again, if there's more questions about that, feel free to ask or to email me at a later time. With that, we will end the presentation. I'll pause here and see if there's any questions before we end up for tonight. Okay, are there any questions regarding the rules of fasting? If I will be traveling for 11 days during Ramadan, but the longest I will be in any one place is 8 days, can I fast? No, unless you are a frequent traveler and that label applies to you. But otherwise, no, if you're not somebody who frequently travels, according to what's not just frequent travel, but frequent travel according to the Islamic guidelines, then if you're traveling around different cities, even if as long as you're not staying 10 days in one place, then you would not be able to fast. If I live in Toronto, but I was born in Montreal, I lived there until I was 4. Is it my hometown? Can I pray full and fast there? Yes, Montreal is your hometown. Toronto would be possibly your hometown if you've taken it as your residence and you're here for a long time, then it would be your hometown. Yeah, so if you lived in another city, then if you've left that city, then that's no longer a hometown. If you were to go back and visit there, then you wouldn't be able to fast. You'd have to pray shortened prayers. You wouldn't be able to pray your full prayers unless you're planning on spending 10 days there or more. So, there was a request that was made to repeat what I said regarding the hometown. It wasn't a brief answer, so I'm not able to just repeat it. Again, if somebody has questions about that, just email me, inshallah, I will email them back. The place which is our birthplace, that's considered our watan. And whenever our watan is a place which, it's our hometown. And even if we've left and moved on to another place, when I go back to my hometown, then I observe my full prayers, I can fast there as well. Just a couple more minutes if there are any more questions. So, if somebody enters the state of janaba after the fajr, for example, somebody is asleep, and assuming that in their sleep they entered it, in that case, they wake up and then they realize they're in the state of janaba, then there's no problem. They go back to sleep and they can do the ghusl when they wake up. The issue about ghusl comes up when somebody, you know, in their sleep they enter the state of janaba, they have a dream, for example. In that case, they have to make sure, and it's at night when that happens, and they realize it at night. In that case, they have to make sure that they've done the ghusl before the fajr time sets in. Now, if you live in a place for a few years, and you leave with no intention of moving back, but you still visit occasionally, when you visit, you're a visitor, you're not a resident there. So you would not be able to keep your fasting there, and you would not be able to pray full either. Okay, well, thank you all for participating in this webinar. I believe that there is going to be a questionnaire that you'll be given as you leave this meeting. So if you can help the Academy of Islam, of Learning Islam, out by filling out that questionnaire, then it will be helpful in order to help them improve their future offerings. Please pray for us. These are special times and special days and special nights. And keep us in your du'a. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.